Welcome, my friends, to Art House Radio. I am Troy, walking around at the end of November in this beautiful weather in Michigan here. Nice sun and sunny. I'm wearing a mask because there are people around, of course. You got to get that vitamin D when you're in the upper parts of the country and it gets sunny. So you have to go outside, and that's what everybody does. So just to be safe, you know, you wear a mask. Hopefully you can hear me fine. Now, listen, I got this book in the mail, Marcel Duchamp, The Afternoon Interviews. I'm very excited about it. Haven't read anything in this book. I don't know anything about it. I saw it on Instagram and I thought, that looks like an interesting book, so I ordered it. So I thought, why don't I just read random passages from this book for you today? Does that sound like a good idea? I'll be like old Bing Crosby sitting by the fireside reading Chuck Dickens' Tale of Two Cities or A Christmas Carol or whatever it is. You know, I was a long time ago, I was in graduate school, writing pieces for string quartet, or actually it was a saxophone quartet, and I always have trouble titling things, and I said to someone, I don't know what to do for a title here, it seems so arbitrary, it's written after the fact, you know, after the piece, it's not about anything, it just sounds rhythmically and sonically clashing together, harmoniously sometimes. And he said to me, how many pages is it? And I said, I don't know, like 23, and he goes, grab a book, a random book, go to page 23 and select the 23rd word. That's what you should call it. And I thought, that's a brilliant idea. Who cares? So that's the idea behind this episode, Marcel Duchamp, The Afternoon Interviews. Are you ready? Before I do that, remember, patreon.com/arthouseradio, at Spaces with Light, that's me on Instagram, and arthouse.radio on Instagram. All right, Marcel Duchamp. If you don't know anything about Marcel Duchamp, he's a conceptual artist. You can find lots of things about him online. One of the earliest, maybe the first conceptual artists, was a great painter, did this painting called Nude Descending the Staircase or Stairs or something. I love that painting, but some of his colleagues were like, this is terrible, and it's this, and it's that, and it's not this, and it's not that. And so he's like, all right, fuck you guys, watch what I do next. And then he came back with an exhibit with this, and then things like this and this. Basically took everyday objects and made them art, and by destroying the use function of them, they became art. Raised all kinds of beautiful questions. I'm sure people are still angry about it. Nevertheless, I love Marcel Duchamp and I'm excited about this book. Let's get started. Excerpt 1, Calvin Tompkins, the interviewer. Today I'd like to ask you about your life in New York before the First World War. You said that the city has changed a great deal since then. Duchamp. Well, life has changed all over the world. One little detail is taxes. In 1916 and 1920, taxes were non-existent, or so unimportant that people never thought of them. Today, when March or April approaches, everybody is hectic about paying taxes and saying they can't buy this or that because their taxes are due. This form of fever did not exist at all back then, and then the rest of life as a whole was much quieter, at least in the relationship of man to man. There was less of the rat race that we see now. I mean, the whole globe is rat racing now. America is no exception. Tompkins. And yet, in spite of all this commercialism, the rat race is still... And the rat race, it's still a fact that there's such a great deal going on among younger artists now. There's so much more inventiveness and excitement. Duchamp. Yes, there was less activity then than now. There were not as many artists as today. The profession of being an artist, of becoming an artist, was only left to a few compared to what it is today. When a young man not having special aptitude for anything will say, well, I'll try art, in my day, young people who didn't know what to do tried medicine or studied to become a lawyer. It was the thing to do. It was rather simple, and the examinations were not as long as they are today. You could be a doctor in 4 years in France, at least. And here, I don't know. It was probably also this long, not like now. All these things make a large difference in the lives of young people today. Tompkins, do you think the idea has spread that art is easy? Duchamp. It's not that it's done more easily, but there is more of an outlet for it. Exchanging art for dollars did not exist then, except for a few artists of that time. The life of an artist in 1915 was non-existent as a money-making proposition, far from it. Many more people are miserable today because they try to make a living from painting and can't. There is so much competition. Tompkins. But isn't all the new art activity in one sense a healthy sign? Duchamp. In a way, if you consider it from the social angle, but from the aesthetic angle, I think it's very detrimental. In my opinion, such an abundant production can only result in mediocrity. There's no time to make very fine work. The pace of production is such that it becomes another kind of rat race. Not rat, but I don't know what. Tompkins. Doesn't this also reflect a change in the concept of what art is? A loss of faith in the creation of masterpieces and an attempt to make art a part of daily life? Duchamp. Exactly. It's what I call the integration of the artist into society, which means he's on par with the lawyer, with the doctor. 50 years ago, we were pariahs. A young girl's parents would never let her marry an artist. Excerpt 2. Tompkins. What was the idea of the coal sacks? Duchamp. These ideas never had any direct rational explanation. If you wanted to be a surrealist, that was one of the things you looked for. This time we gave more importance to the ceiling, that's all. Anything that could bring out the meeting of two incompatible elements would be welcome. There was also an electric heater on which we put coffee grains during the exhibition, so that when you came into the show, you'd smell the coffee first. The idea of introducing a smell was new enough to them. Tompkins, did you enjoy that kind of activity? Duchamp, yes, it amused me. It was done with a spirit of real playfulness and nice people. I mean, at that time, there weren't so many intestinal difficulties among the surrealists. There was more cohesion. Now it would be impossible. Today, the young generation takes it so damn seriously, so that surrealism is getting to be a bore. It's too dogmatic in the mind of these young people. They are not inventive or imaginative. They use all the ideas they have seen or heard about, use them again in dogmatic form, and probably write books about it. Excerpt 3. Tompkins. All ideas have to change. Duchamp. Yes. The futurists really were, for that reason, much more of their own time than the cubists. The cubists were old-fashioned, static painters. Even the cutting into facets was a timid form of breaking out of rules. Tompkins. Was there a feeling of rivalry, do you think, between the cubists and the futurists at that time? Duchamp. Oh, enormous. It was not even a rivalry. It was plain disdain on the part of the cubists. You see, the cubists were still old-fashioned painters who spent their days painting and had no idea what was going on around them, just plain toiling every day. Whereas the futurists were men of the world, they knew what was going on. At the time, I didn't know the futurists because I was too young, but then I hardly knew my cubist friends at that time. Tompkins, were you interested at that time in aspects of technology that were going on around you? Duchamp, no. It was a matter of applying to art of the time, cubist and fauve and impressionist, something that was not ever thought of by these fathers. I wouldn't want to copy an impressionist painting or use their tricks or their theories like the simultaneism of Seurat. That didn't interest me. I wanted to find something to escape that prison of tradition. Tradition is the prison in which you live. How can you escape from those pincers? Tompkins, most artists have been content to make do with tradition. Duchamp, well, then they go on with it, but when they are ready to be themselves, things hold them down in spite of themselves. The education is so strong in every child, it holds them like a chain. That's what I wanted to avoid, and yet I didn't completely get free. But I tried to, consciously. I unlearned to draw. I actually had to forget with my hand. With my paintings around 1910, it was already unlearning, or learning how to forget. There was also systematic distortion, which was my way since 1900, and probably before that even. In the case of Matisse, I'm sure he had to decide to systematically draw differently from what he had learned in school. Final excerpt. How long ago did you come to this conclusion? Duchamp. Well, little by little, I don't know how it came exactly. It doesn't take the form of a very important conclusion because it doesn't change anything. Art is one of the activities, no more than that. Tompkins. You've made a distinction between the works of art that go into art history and the works that are still alive. Duchamp. That's a little amusing idea, but I don't know whether it has any foundation. After a work has lived almost the life of a man, 20 or 40 years, it doesn't matter the number of years. Comes a period when that work of art, if it is still looked at by onlookers, is put in a museum. A new generation decides that's all right. And those two ways of judging a work of art certainly don't have anything in common, in my opinion. That's why I say the life and death of a work of art, death meaning posterity, meaning art history. Tompkins, you must have an interest in art history because of your meticulous reproduction of your work. Duchamp, yes, it has been my occupation, but as I told you, it's not my concern to decide whether it's art. I made the art, I'm the artist, who has absolutely no inkling of what he's been doing. Tompkins, what did make you want to reproduce your work? Duchamp, I don't know. I sold the things, I made money, part of it was business, small business. I can assure you, no, there was no reason, except that having a small production, it was easier to do it than if I had the rate of a painting a month or something like Dubuffet, an artist. In my case, it was fun for me having a small production to make it into a group more expressive of one's life. Tompkins, was that more interesting to you than making something new? Duchamp, well, I didn't want to do anything new. I'd had enough. The minute you systemize anything, if I had systemized the ready-mades, I could have made 100,000 ready-mades in 10 years easily. They would have been fake because they would have been quick, easily chosen, and then regretted a year later. I would be compromised, he laughs. So when people find something interesting in what I did and then use it as a system, I have my little doubt about it. At least I'm conscious of the danger. Anything systematized becomes a sterile very soon. There is nothing that has eternal value. It's according to the way society takes it. The poor Mona Lisa is gone because no matter how wonderful her smile may be, it's been looked at so much that the smile has disappeared. I believe that when 1 million people look at a painting, they change the thing by looking alone, physically. See what I mean? They change the physical image without knowing it. There is an action, transcendental of course, that absolutely destroys whatever you could see when it was live. Marcel Duchamp, the afternoon interviews. Wasn't very much, should get on there. All right, that's all I got for you today. Thanks for watching. Patreon.com/arthouseradio. I'm at Spaces with Light. This is arthouse.radio on Instagram. Folks, it's the giving season and arts podcasts like this could use your help. And if you don't want to support this one, support something. All right, till next time.